This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we explore two speculative fiction novels that challenge our understanding of consciousness, communication, and the human condition. First, we speak with Carrie Groner about The Way, a post-pandemic road novel that blends adventure, Buddhist philosophy, and a hopeful vision of the future after our current civilization has been largely swept away. Then we welcome Sylvia Park to discuss Luminous, a hauntingly prescient novel about AI, identity, and the blurred line between human and machine. Both stories wrestle with profound questions. What does it mean to live ethically in a fractured world? And can technology truly replace or surpass our humanity? Join us for a thought-provoking journey into these two visionary tales. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. After a devastating pandemic has killed off some 90% of Americans, if not the world, a devotee of Buddhism goes on a road trip with two extraordinary animal companions, whose speech he's learned to decipher. The scarcity of people has allowed wildlife to return in numbers not seen since before white settlers stole the land from the indigenous peoples. This is a setting for Carrie Groner's novel, The Way. It takes the reader on a post-pandemic journey across a transformed America, where survival and spiritual inquiry go hand in hand. His protagonist, Will, a caretaker from a Buddhist monastery, embarks on a dangerous mission while accompanied by a raven named Poe and Cassie the cat. Groner's novel is a fable about a post-apocalyptic America where the world is beginning to be healed, a dystopia with hope, if you will. It explores the question, how to act without harm in a dangerous world, and another, how to heal our relationship to the other animals we share the planet with. Finally, it's a plea for us to consider the catastrophes we are hurtling headlong toward before it's too late. Carrie Groner, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
This picaresque road trip novel takes place around mid-century, 2048, after a devastating pandemic has killed something like 80% of the human population, or at least 80% of the U.S. population. It's been called a post-apocalyptic dystopian novel, and I agree with the post-apocalyptic part, but I don't agree with the dystopian part, because although the circumstances are dire, the characters are really charming, and there's so much to like about this time and its circumstances. So give us a sense of this time and place in America.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you point that out, because in some ways, it's a little bit like the country would have been 150 years ago when, you know, there were no internal combustion engines, there was no gasoline, there was maybe some kerosene, and the population was sparse and centered around places where you could grow food, you know, near water sources, where there was arable land. And so in one way, it's a look forward. In another way, I guess you could say it's a bit of a look backward. Because it's a difficult life. The point you make, too, about the nature of the characters is a good one, I think, because it is a bit of a hopeful story. It's not all doom and gloom. I think The Road is an excellent novel, and I read it a few years ago. And although I thought the writing was great, I would never want to read it again. And, you know, in this case, I think what I'm hearing from people is that they actually would like to read it again because it does give them a sense of hope about the future. It's curious, too, because it's also a little bit myth-based. You know, I don't know if you know the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, but it's a little bit inspired by that myth where Orpheus goes down to the underworld to try to bring back his lost love. And that's something that all of us would do, of course, if we could. So there's a little bit of that flavor in it, too.
Yes, although it doesn't have the same ending as the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Right, it's a little bit of a happier ending, it's true.
So tell us about your protagonist, Will, who is in his 50s and one of the oldest people around.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that is, you know, when you get into situations where it's a bit like a third world country, which in the world of the novel, the whole world is a third world country at that point, then it has an effect on the average age of the population. And you can see this in developing countries today. Before about the 1930s in the U.S. and in other countries, before the invention of antibiotics and public health measures of the kind that we take for granted today, most people only lived to be 35 or 40. The average age of the population was between 15 and 25. And that's the way it is now in a lot of developing countries, most developing countries, in fact. So I wanted to be true to that in this world that I was creating, where there's no antibiotics, there's no vaccines. So it's kind of reverted to the sort of world that we see now in developing countries, where most people are, you know, they don't get much older than 35, 40 years old.
We're actually with the institution of RFK Jr. as the head of our health system in this country, we might get there much more rapidly than 2045.
I know, it's a scary prospect. It's an unprecedented situation where, for the first time in American history, the head of Health and Human Services may actually present a danger to the American people.
So Will has two charming animal companions. There's Poe the Raven, and that's P-E-A-U, and there's Cassie the Cat. So tell us about these companions.
Well, one of the things I wanted to explore in the book is introduced in the epigraph with that quote from Gary Snyder's book, about how in a healed world, in a sort of different world slightly than the one we live in, the humans and animals all can talk and understand each other. And this too goes back to a lot of things from mythology. You know, in myths and fables and children's stories, it's very common for humans and animals to just talk to each other. It's the most natural thing in the world. And, you know, the only place where there's kind of a barrier to that is when we get more into literary fiction. And I kind of chafed against that limitation, because I do think of this book as speculative literary fiction, but I wanted there to be some communication there. So, you know, I introduced this as a kind of inexplicable aspect of the way the world has changed. So we have Cassie, who, you know, previously been owned by someone. She has a name tag and a collar and shows up at the meditation center where Will is living as the caretaker, since everyone else is long dead. And then Poe the Raven, who flies in at one point also, and they all just sort of get to know each other and begin to communicate. As Will says at one point, if you can learn Morse, you can learn Raven. So there's, you know, a similar system of clicks and vocalizations and so forth. So I liked the idea of having those animal companions before he eventually starts meeting more human beings again.
Yeah, and say more about this kind of world healing that this interspecies communication is about.
You know, I have a sense that part of our alienation from the natural world as human beings has to do with kind of looking at animals as property, you know, and that's a very old thing. It goes back a long time, millennia, where, you know, we have our oxen and our dogs and so forth, and they're property. In the same way, actually, women were considered property for a very long time. And I think that's a bad way to go about life. I think it's really much better if we can see the animals that we share the world with as colleagues and companions. And sure, their minds are very different from our minds in many cases. In some cases, they're not so different from our minds. But as I mentioned in the book, you know, there's a lot of increasing evidence using functional MRI machines and AI vectoring that indicates that animals have very similar emotional centers in their brains that we have. And so, you know, by extension, a similar emotional way of interacting with the world and experiencing the world, even though their minds may be very different from ours. And I just think it's important to recognize that and take it into consideration, and I wanted it to be part of the book.
Yes, I mean, after all, we did evolve from something.
Sure. I mean, it's everybody knows this, but 98% of our genes are the same genes that chimpanzees have. What's really interesting, though, is that, for dolphins, it's like 95% or something. I don't know the exact numbers, so someone will probably call in and correct me. But even, when you get down to it, it's like for some plants, we have 50% of the genes that a lot of plants have in common. So, it's been a common evolution, and we're not as different as we like to think. I think part of the reason people have tended to objectify animals, and this, goes back much beyond Descartes, but Descartes, the French philosopher, talked about animals kind of as soulless meat machines, really not worth our consideration as actual beings. And as I say in the book, anybody who's looked their own beagle in the eye knows that that's just nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. You say your character says, Will says, this whole communications drives a stake into the old shibboleth of anthropomorphism. I mean, in other words, the idea that we've had all along by just common sense and opening our eyes is we know that the animals have these emotions. It's not, quote, anthropomorphism, something, some fiction that we've created for ourselves. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that whole concept of anthropomorphism is, it's saying that, well, we don't really know what animals experience. We're just projecting our emotions onto them and so forth. And I make the case that really that's part of the whole emotional intellectual system of exploiting animals. If you want to exploit a creature, or if you want to make war on the people in the next tribe, the first thing you do is you basically dehumanize them, or you take away their souls. You say, well, they don't really have a soul, they don't really have emotions, so we can treat them however we want to treat them. And I think that's an extremely unfortunate way to approach the world.
And one that Will talks about is having brought us to the apocalyptic point at which he finds himself. There's something else too that is has happened with this, the decimation of the human population, and that's the return of nature. You have vast flocks of passenger pigeons and herds of grazing animals. So why did you put that into this wonderful novel, by the way? Incredible read, The Way, Cary Groner.
Thank you. I put that in because I was trying to figure out what the world would be like in the sudden absence of human beings. If you suddenly go from 8 billion people to a couple of hundred million, what's going to happen in the world? And about the time that in fact, before I was thinking about this book, I read a wonderful book called The World Without Us, sort of a thought experiment by Alan Weisman.
I interviewed him many years ago about that book.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, well, he was teaching at the University of Arizona when I was in grad school there, so I was aware of the book when it came out and did read it fairly early on. And then when I started planning this book, I remembered it and went back to it and to just kind of see what exactly it was that he was saying. And it was really helpful. It was great, and I did put it in my acknowledgments, in fact, because I was trying to figure out what sort of world would this be, and then there it was, all kind of laid out in this great thought experiment that he did.
Oh, that's great because I thought a lot about his book as I was reading The Way. Now, Will has been charged by an old friend, a scientist, Lars, with bringing something to a surviving group of scientists in California, which seems to have more of an infrastructure than the Arizona that he's in, that may result in a cure of virus X. And he is being, oh, you know what? I'm actually going to start. Sorry, let's go back to something else because I wanted to pick up more about Will. So there's a very important aspect of this book that we haven't spoken about yet, and that is the fact that Will is a Buddhist, although you did mention that he was in a Buddhist monastery. And this really plays, I think, a role in what one might even think is the double entendre of the title. I mean, The Way, on the one hand, it's a road trip. He goes on a journey. There is a way. but he also does a lot of thinking about the Tao, or the way of being. So tell us about that.
Well, this was my orientation personally, and it was one of the things that interested me about this subject, because I'm a Buddhist and have been for more than 30 years. And, you know, it's not always an easy path. It proposes certain ethical conundrums that you have to deal with, sometimes almost on a daily or weekly basis. You know, how to live a harmless life, how to live a respectful life. So I was interested in writing a book that addressed some of those issues. And of course, you know, you kind of want to put your characters in the crucible a bit, right? You to really force the issues out into the surface and heat things up. So that's where that comes from. It comes from just my own personal interest in it and experience with it, and what that led me to in terms of constructing a narrative.
So Will has been charged. The reason he's on this journey is because an old friend who's a scientist has given him something to bring to scientists in California, where they have more of an infrastructure that may result in a cure of this virus X that has decimated the world population. And he's being pursued by a band of villains who are led by a man named Flynn. And so this idea of a Buddhist conundrum or an ethical conundrum comes up as he contemplates the question of evil, because he has to think about how is he going to deal with this enemy. So tell us how does he think about his nemesis, Flynn, and how he must deal with him?
Well, you know, the ethical conundrum at the heart of that is that, you know, the greater benefit is to get the cure for disease X to California. And I should clarify one point, by the way. The disease that really wiped out the population happened 15 years previously and was an avian flu virus. The disease he's dealing with now that they're calling disease X is a different, you know, there are several new diseases that have arisen, as well as older diseases like TB that have reappeared. And so this appears to be one of the new diseases. It affects people's minds. It basically is kind of like an accelerated dementia, so that people begin to lose their minds and then ultimately die after just a few months. So that's the initial avian flu has largely vanished from the world, but the disease that he's dealing with now that this cure is about it appears to be a kind of dementia disease, accelerated in some ways because it may be viral. They're not quite sure. That's addressed a little in more detail at the end of the book. But in terms of the conundrum he faces, it's clear that the greatest benefit to the world is going to be to get this possible cure, this chemical compound, to California, where people may be able to work with it and turn it into a therapeutic agent. But he's being pursued by someone who wants it for his own purposes. And because he has taken a vow to do no harm, as Buddhists do, it poses the problem of how to fulfill his mission without harming the person who's trying to harm him. And so he gets a little advice about this along the way, which is essentially, you know, it's better if, you know, harm doesn't come to these guys from your hands, you know, as a result of your actions, but rather as a result of their own actions. And Will points out to his friend and teacher, well, you know, things get a little bit tangled up. It's not so easy to to decide that. And so, you know, basically the advice he gets is, well, you know, do the best you can, try not to harm them yourself. If harm should come to them as a result of their actions, that's not really your problem. And so I realized as I was working with this, you know, it actually offered me opportunities as a writer to really make the narrative more interesting, because Will can't just choose the simplest, most obvious solutions to getting rid of his problem. He can't just ambush his pursuers and shoot them. You know, he has to come up with ways so that he can continue his own quest, but see to it that they don't interfere with that quest or stop that quest, And yet, if any harm comes to them, it has to be a result of what they do, not what he does. So it makes it much more complex and interesting as a narrative as well, I think.
Yeah, it really does. Now, there's another point in the book. You mentioned the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which in some ways this book reminded me of. It was one of my very favorite books when I was younger. And I thought it might be one of yours as well.
Yeah, it was.
There's another interesting point in the book and kind of relates to this dystopia or not, and really to the hopeful cast of the book, because Will comes upon a community that has formed, and he assumes at first that it must be a hierarchy with a king and a queen at its head, but he's wrong. The king is actually a mayor, is duly elected. So talk a little bit about this community and how it actually, you know, surprises us. It steps out of the frame of the classic dystopian novel.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was trying to figure out was how would people live, you know, in this world? How would they be able to survive? And as I suggested previously, you know, it's going to be an agrarian society for the most part. You're going to need water source and arable land. And so I sort of made up this town of Cottonwood, which is on the old San Juan River in the Southwest U.S. And yeah, I wanted to kind of see it at first through Will's eyes because he's a little scared and suspicious. He doesn't really know what he's found here. It's been a long time since he's seen much of other people. And so he gets the feeling that these two people that he thinks are maybe like a king and a queen of this little community, that's how they operate. And in fact, he later learns that she is the mayor of the town and she was elected. And so this kind of vestige of American democracy lives on, even though it's in a much reduced state.
You know, for all its charm, I think this book, The Way, is a warning. Will at one point says that he'd read of ordinary people in the years before World War I and World War II, and I'm going to quote from him, "You could see the shadow of the exterminating angel falling over them, a sudden cool darkness they mostly didn't notice. How could they not have seen it coming?" And those words really rang so true for me at, you know, this time that we are in. I have been warning of this, I think, since 9/11, you know, that we are headed the wrong way in this world and especially in this country. And I felt that this book was in some way you working that out for yourself as well. I wonder if you could respond to that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I'm really glad you noticed that section because a lot of people kind of blow by it, but it was important to me because you do see this pattern, you know, before World War I, before World War II, where in hindsight, we could just see, oh man, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and then catastrophe. And you do wonder, how did they not see it coming? And the point I make there is, you know, it's very hard for us as a people to make those adjustments in our societies. Things kind of start going in a certain way. And I think the way I put it in the book is it's full throttle right over the cliff because we just don't seem to be able to recognize what's happening and turn away in time. And I do worry that that's what's going on now, both with, you know, with RFK Jr. in charge of infectious disease. What can you say except, wow, good luck with that. And with, you know, increasing saber rattling between this one axis of North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China, and then kind of the rest of the world on the other hand. And we've all got nukes, and all the old nuclear weapons limitation treaties are expiring now. No one seems to be particularly interested in renewing them. China is building its arsenal very quickly. And it just seems, you know, if you just take a moment and look at it, it seems so obvious that this is headed for unprecedented catastrophe. And how can we not see that? How can we not change course? How can we not negotiate a way out of this? And yet it seems we're completely incapable of doing that. And I just find that terrifying.
Well, hopefully it'll be the pandemic and not the nuclear war so that the natural world has a chance to recover.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's not a great choice, but if you had that choice, I would agree with you.
Well, it is a wonderful book of this novel, The Way. And Cary Groner, it's been wonderful to talk with you about it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Cary Groner is an author, playwright, and teacher based in the San Francisco Bay Area. In addition to The Way, he's the author of a previous novel, Exiles, and his short stories have appeared in several major venues. The Way is out from Spiegel & Grau. Next up, a novel about the relationships between humans and robots. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Sylvia Park's brilliant debut novel, Luminous, takes place in a future United Korea where the lives of robots and humans are deeply intertwined. Park examines the ethics of artificial intelligence, the nature of love, and the potential for AI to evolve into something beyond human comprehension. Luminous is a captivating read, but it's also so much more. It had me thinking hard about such questions as, can a machine truly love? And if so, what does that mean for our understanding of selfhood and emotion? And even more, what are our responsibilities towards machines that we have made for our use, yet are as sentient as we are? As we move closer to the kind of world depicted in the novel, these are questions we would do well to ponder. Sylvia Park lives in both South Korea and Lawrence, Kansas. Their stories have been published in Black Warrior Review, TOR, The Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy, and elsewhere. They teach fiction at the University of Kansas. Sylvia Park, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, Francesca. It's so good to be here.
Luminous. This is just such a profoundly thought-provoking and emotionally affecting novel. It takes place in a now reunified Korea after a brutal reunification war in a society where sentient robots, many nearly indistinguishable from humans, are tightly woven into the social fabric. First, give us a snapshot of this future Korea.
So this is a Korea that I had to imagine it in the future. And one of the reasons why it was really important for me to set this book in like a recognizable Korea is because this country, the country that I grew up in, it's really, really fought hard to survive, to exist. If you look at Korea's history, its history extends for millennia, essentially. But it's had numerous times where it was almost completely obliterated. It was swallowed up by very powerful neighboring countries. And I think that that's why when I try to envision a future, I wanted to shy away from the future where just like nations just seem, you know, decimated, or they've kind of just combined into this like pan Asia sort of like blob. And I wanted to respect Korea for how it fought so hard to retain its sense of identity, its sovereignty. But then to imagine Korea in the future, I had to also think about what's going to happen to North Korea. And the issue of North Korea has always been, it's been this wound that I think a lot of Koreans, they kind of put it in the back of their minds. It's like, they can't really sit with it for too long because it's just so hard to wrap their minds around.
Why is that?
It's because we now are at a generation where the majority of people, the families that have been separated from their families in the North during the Korean War, they're about to pass on. So at this point, we now have generations that don't remember families they may have left behind or were separated with during the North. And so what that means is that a lot of the memory, the trauma that we have as a nation is, it's inherited, but it's not ours. And I think that's a very different kind of haunting. It's a haunting that it reminds us of a kind of yearning where we realize that we yearn or miss something that we never knew. And that's why I think whenever we see North Korea in the news, there's always this kind of combined reaction. On one hand, we kind of scoff and be like, once again, threat of nuclear war. Okay, let's move on with our day. But there's also this immense sympathy and kind of pain when we see North Koreans, at least in the news. I remember when we saw the last Olympics, I think it was the table tennis team. There was that moment where the Chinese, the North Korean, the South Korean teams, they just took a selfie together. And we really ached for that. We thought it's just so sad that we carry this sort of this schism with us generation after generation until it just we've become two completely different nations.
That's so interesting because that aspect is not really at the forefront of this novel. More of the forefront is the war, the
Yes.
reunification war. Say a little bit about that and what role that plays before we get into the characters in the story.
I wanted to write about robots, and I think that in approaching this issue with robots integrating society, I had to think about how did robots become integrated society? And the thing about technology and about technological advancement is that it usually occurs, there's advancement in multiple spaces. So we see the sort of flashiest one is the tech industry. It's the tech industry kind of like, you know, they make a lot of big promises. They really hype up things. And then we have development in academic spaces, and then we have development in military spaces. And a lot of technology actually comes from experimentation and development in the military, and then it trickles into sometimes mass market. And that's what happened with the internet. So I imagined that with approaching robots in this reunified Korea, it must have been tested during the reunification war. And I say reunification war in a way that I don't think I foregrounded too much again in the novel because I don't think my book is intended to be a book about the war. It's rather more about the way the war lingers and the way the war haunts the characters in the story, particularly with one of the main characters who was a war veteran.
So now let's talk about these characters. In many ways, this is a family story. And while it takes place at a time when all the family members are adults, there are a lot of references to when they were children. And there are three siblings, two of whom are the natural children of the parents. That's June, the war veteran you've just referred to, and his sister, Morgan. And June, by the way, is a transgender male. And the third is a robot, Yo-Yo, who was devised and created by the father. So tell us about these siblings and their relationship to each other, and particularly to their sibling, their brother, Yo-Yo.
So June and Morgan met Yo-Yo. Yo-Yo was introduced to them as immediately their brother by their father, who was the creator of Yo-Yo, as you have mentioned. I think they were around 8 years old. So June was 8, Morgan was 4. And I was really interested in the idea of if robots are meant to start integrating into our lives. I think a lot of stories really focus on the way they integrate as romantic partners. But I was curious about what would it be like if we started using robots for this really obvious labor that I think a lot of people, a lot of families grapple with, which is childcare, that we introduce robots into our lives because we want them to raise our children, because people are just, they're busy, they're trying to survive, they're working, and in childcare, it's just become so expensive to the point that it's deterring a lot of families from wanting to have children. And so I imagined, okay, this robot was introduced into his family. This robot looks like a child, but the robot is introduced as an older brother because, again, I think the family kind of intended for this robot to take on a bit more of a caretaking role. And June and Morgan, they fall in love with him. They accept him as their brother. They are just so, he's so affectionate to them. And they have all these beautiful memories about him. But I think, particularly with June, as he was growing older, there was a schism because his brother Yo-Yo was designed to look around 12 years old. And then June was now starting to reach that age. And then he surpassed that age. He became a teenager. And I just thought it must be so surreal having a robot in your family, a person in your family that never changes. They never physically change, they never age. And they just seem kind of, it's not even arrested development. It almost feels like they're frozen in time. And so that was the particular relationship, the tensions I wanted to explore, and how that affected them in childhood, and how that still affects them as adults.
They fall in love with Yo-Yo. Does he fall in love with them?
Oh, that is a question that I cannot answer.
Because that's really, a central question. You know, each robot is created, or the robots are created for a purpose.
Yes.
Consumer robots are created, you know, yes, maybe for childcare, but also for companionship. They're created to love. Their purpose in life is to actually love. But the question comes at a certain point in the novel. Now, Morgan grows up and she becomes a robot creator. She is a personality designer. Is that the term?
Yes. Yeah. Personality programmer.
And she has never had a boyfriend, and she creates a robot, Steven, to be her boyfriend. But it doesn't turn out the way she expects. So tell us a little bit about their relationship and what happens to it, and kind of center this idea of love. Who is loving whom?
So I think that for Morgan, she overthinks. She is very much one of those types who are really trapped in her own head. And that's pretty much one of her biggest obstacles, because she creates this boyfriend who not only does she create him to love her, but she actually models him after her favorite movie actor. So he's basically a copyright violation in some ways. And that makes it very difficult for her to take him out. Because I think that I imply in this book that robots are, particularly in Korea, they're designed in a way where they can kind of blend in. They can look like a person, unless like they have this very particular kind of face that's very familiar as a robot model. So I think that Morgan's difficulty to take Steven out contributes to why she really struggles in her relationship with him, because she's like, okay, you're supposed to be my boyfriend, but you're kind of just a servant. You're in my house. You're taking care of all the housework. And this is obviously associated usually with feminine labor. And I think she struggles to unpack also a lot of internalized misogyny, because she struggles to have a relationship with a man that doesn't seem like a man to her, that seems subservient, that seems overly conscientious and thoughtful. And it seems to be almost everything she would ask for, but because she created him, because she kind of sees past, at least she thinks she sees past a lot of the wiring, that she sees sort of the programming, how he's responding, what exactly is going on, and sort of its decision tree. I think that's why she just has this immense distrust toward him, because she doesn't trust herself. She has no faith in herself.
Sylvia Park. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to a sample from Luminous. You know, at one point, he seems to really fall in love with her. And I guess I wanted to interrogate that a little bit more. I mean, if love is being programmed, is it love?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a question that I think readers should try to answer, because I think that's the real, and I think someone actually mentioned this in another interview. They asked me why I didn't write from the perspective of any of the robot characters. So that would be Steven, Yo-Yo, and then there's another robot character in the book. And my decision for that is because I wanted that to remain a mystery, that we have really no look into their heads. We don't know what's going on. All we know is that we have programmed these incredibly convincing and lovely and charming people, like people who seem like people. But we don't know if they can actually feel the way we do, that they care for us the way we do, or if they've just been fine-tuned to be perfect at it.
And that's also part of what Morgan can't really trust. I mean, after all, she's programmed Steven, but he goes a little rogue, and he goes rogue in this direction of loving her. She tries to break up with him, and he just keeps on forgetting she's done that.
Yes, Steven he starts to break down a little bit in the second half of the book.
Yeah, we don't want to give anything away. But I guess if the reader is supposed to answer that question, I would have to go more to the side of he loves her. And why? Because, you know, humans can be programmed too. I mean, we're a combination of evolution. And you could say development of robots is a kind of evolution. And programming of nurture and nature. And is it really all that different? But Yo-Yo, I want to go back to Yo-Yo because tell us about him. Everyone seems to treat him as if he is special. He's not like other robots.
So Yo-Yo is meant to be a mystery in the book. He appears in the novel in the present day, but we find out pretty quickly that Yo-Yo also was part of June and Morgan's lives. So he was part of their childhood. He was their brother when they were growing up. But now June and Morgan are grown up, they're adults. And the book reveals that he disappeared from their lives about, like, I think 14 years ago. I have to go back and count, but it was a while back. And then they don't know what happened to him. And I think the reason why Yo-Yo seems different from other robots is that in this book, the other robots we meet, they have a clear purpose, and their purpose is to be a companion for people, to serve people. But Yo-Yo, when he is introduced, he's introduced to a group of children. They find out that he doesn't really act the way other robots do, and that's because Yo-Yo actually has a very different purpose. And I don't know if I can reveal what the purpose is without going quite into spoiler territory.
Yeah, so Yo-Yo has a different purpose. He almost seems to have had a number of different purposes. One of the things that's interesting is the question of memory, because Yo-Yo, the Yo-Yo we meet in the book, and stop me if I'm going to do a spoiler, but he's a copy of the original in a way. But the robots who succeed their previous iteration download all the personality and all the memories of the previous one. And this comes to kind of the question of what is real and what isn't. I think even Yo-Yo at one point says he's not the same as the original. He differentiates himself. And, this was one of these thought-provoking things because what are we? Are we our personality and our memories only, or are we something beyond that? How did you wrestle with this?
So I wrestled with it by looking a lot at religion because I think it's the age-old question across different religions. And I don't know if this was very obvious to readers, but the book does have a lot of Judeo-Christian references. It also examines Buddhist philosophy. And I think that the way these different religions talk about the soul or the self for me is really fascinating, particularly as, now we have to grapple with technology and how that impacts the way we view the self and the soul. And I do actually differentiate the two, because generally the concept of the soul is that it's considered to be immortal, as opposed to the self is it can be contained within our mortal body and it can die with our body. So I think that with Yo-Yo and the questions that he brings up, I think that also actually highlights, is there a difference between human and robot? Because if there's no such thing as a soul, then really, what's the difference between us?
Or you could look at it another way. I mean, somebody in the book says Yo-Yo has a soul. So, I mean, we could also not be different and have a soul.
Yes, there's actually in Japanese shamanism, in Shinto religion, they believe that souls can also be imbued to objects. And I think that that's something that the characters consider and think about. And in particular, the one who grapples with it is the youngest character in the book, Rujie. And I think it's because for her, the question is actually urgent, it's immediate, it's relevant to what she is struggling with. And what she's struggling with is that she has a progressive illness that might mean that she cannot hold on to her body anymore, or maybe. I think at this point, it seems to imply that it's a terminal diagnosis, but a possibility to subvert that or to avert that is to consider uploading herself into a robotic body. And but what does that mean? Does that mean that she is dying and just uploading a copy of herself, or is she successfully moving on to immortality, this technological immortality?
And also, I mean, there's the whole religious idea that the body is just a shell. The body is just a vessel, right? So then the actual materiality of that, or the form of it, may not matter. But the question also comes down to June, because as you said, he's a war survivor. He was grievously wounded. 78% of his body was destroyed. during the war, so his new body is basically robotic. He has an arm that has wires in it. He's a bionic man. How does he struggle with his new body and his selfhood?
I think June's struggle is especially fraught because of his history. And what I mean by his history is that sort of the wound he carries when he looks back on his childhood is that he rejected his brother. He rejected Yo-Yo, particularly when he started to feel this immense uncertainty, this sort of instability in terms of his relationship with his robot brother. And then the whole question of, is this relationship real? Does my robot brother actually love me? And I think that's why for him to then lose most of his body and then become, as you say, 78% robotic or bionic, as they try to soften the term with when they apply it to humans. I think for him, he really struggles with that because then he asks himself, you know, what really is the difference between us, between human and robot? And what's especially tricky about it too for June is that he is transgender. And for him, the surgery he underwent, the life-saving surgery, and it's life-saving, of course, in all these different ways, it physically transitioned him as well, so that he now has this masculine presenting body that passes, that is almost everything he might have dreamed of, but it's also not his body. It's not his biological body. So there's a lot of tension in that and inner turmoil that I think he continues to struggle with, even though he transitioned into this bionic body quite a few years back.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Sylvia Park about her terrific and thought-provoking novel, Luminous. I want to turn now to how humans treat robots. You know, there's kind of a haunting in this novel of racism, of second-class citizenship. You know, robots, for example, have to sit in the back of the bus. I think of Rosa Parks. But it gets more serious than that. You know, of course, the iconic fear the humans have about robots is that they're going to take over the world and destroy us because they are going to be superior to us. How did you approach that issue, that fear? And then I'm going to ask you a little bit more deeper question about violence.
So I was not that interested in exploring a robot revolution story, which I think is, it's like almost a subgenre at this point, where robots, they take up their arms, they decide down with the humans, and then they overthrow us, or they turn us into batteries. The reason why I wasn't that interested in that is because I think for us to presume that robots want to take over is to really, again, to anthropomorphize them, to assume that they would have these human emotions that are centered on, you know, anger, despair, this injustice. And so I was more interested in seeing how robots are safely integrated into society, but how that corrodes us from within. And what that means, because I don't know if, you know, the robots are turning human in this book. I wonder if sort of the realization some characters have is that robots are actually turning into something else, and we don't know what that else is.
Okay, a different kind of intelligence. I mean, they communicate with each other. They can not only download their own previous iterations' memories, but they can download each other's memories. One of the characters says, we don't really know what that kind of communication means because we can't experience it.
Yes, yeah. In some ways, it's black box. We have no idea what not only sort of their thinking process, but we also don't know what a relationship is between two robots or two robotic intelligence. Because like if they were to present a relationship to us, it's almost like code switching. They might have to like speak out loud to show that they're communicating. But I imagine that if there was no human audience, robots would probably interact in a way that's beyond our imagination.
Now, you mentioned that humans get corroded from within because of this relationship. And that really struck me because, you know, it's like the corrosion that happens with any kind of dominator of other sentient beings. cruelty comes out, a sense of impunity, you know, the urge actually to destroy and to lord it over the others. There is a kind of a illegal practice in the book of a ritualized violence that is organized by a bunch of humans against robots, actually against, in particular, female robots who are stripped nude and brutally assaulted and, in fact, killed. So talk about that aspect of the corrosion of human beings in this society, which has robots integrated in it.
So I drafted Luminous during the pandemic, and when I was writing, I knew that the climactic moment in the book would involve a moment of, you know, a real human depravity. When I say depravity, I mean that it's exactly what you said, the way they hone in on weakness, or the way they decide you will be this outlet, this sort of sacrifice, this tribute for sort of the carelessness of our violence. And when I was first writing this, I thought, oh, this is getting too dark. Like, I don't know if this is right, if I'm just kind of pushing it too hard. But then around the same time, something happened in Korea. They called it a scandal at first. This case broke out in Korea called the Nth Room case. And what it was a sort of digital human trafficking where girls were being blackmailed and were being sexually trafficked in cyber chat rooms. And it was, I think, a version of this that's quite similar is actually the Pellico trial. That conversation was particularly taking place last year, but the way people have used technology to kind of find more and more creative ways to enact such destruction and exploitation. So that's why I imagine that as a human race, we're so good at dehumanizing those that we perceive as lesser and weaker than us, that I think with robots, it won't even be a workout. The dehumanization will just be immediate. It will be automatic. And what I really question is, if robots exist in this world, would they serve as an outlet or would they amplify our dark urges?
Wow, because I was actually going to ask you, and this is my last question. I mean, the robots are in a very real sense slaves, but I felt this novel seems to struggle toward a vision of equality between robots and humans. And you've just said that what you foresee is the opposite, but do you think it would be possible to create, you know, is another world possible between humans and robots?
Oh, that's a hard question, because I think the only way equality would be possible is if robots were like us, because we already struggle with equality and equity between fellow humans, right? Because we love to find ways to talk about how different we are, or find ways that the other is not as deserving, or we just find ways to discriminate against them. But I think with our struggle for equality between robots and humans, it's, for me, it actually seems quite impossible, because I don't think robots are going to be like us. I think they might actually turn out to be a completely different creation or a different existence. And therefore, their concept of equality might also be completely different from what we envision. And at the moment in my book, robots are, as you described, treated as second class. They're also treated as property. But what I wanted to portray, especially with the end of Luminous, is to hint at the thing about the singularity is it's a tipping point, because once we do tip over, then it's a whole new world.
Say more about that.
What I mean is that if robots have perhaps do surpass us in not only intelligence, but perhaps also, there's this one character that uses this phrase, he calls it artificial empathy. This idea of robots being much more interlinked than us, and that interlinking actually creates this empathy that humans are just not capable of because we're so individualized. Ironically, an analogy, a comparison would be the way we're connected on the internet, but actually that just makes us even more feral and we just seem to not tolerate each other and tolerate each other's differences. But with robots, this character is perhaps arguing that, and I don't really particularly take the position of this character, rather I'm positioning this character as one of the opinions in the book. But this character is making the argument that robots have a more sort of divine empathy, and that they're able to be truly connected with each other and not to be in conflict with each other. and but at the same time exist as individuals. And so, yeah, I think that's what I mean by the brave new world, because if robots do surpass us in intelligence, but not only intelligence, but emotions, in capacity for love, for whatever that looks like, it's going to be a completely different world that I think I'd be curious to see how others might imagine it.
Well, Sylvia Park, your novel is luminous. It is luminous, in fact, and it has just been such an honor to talk with you about it.
Thank you, Francesca. It was just, I love the way your questions push and push. They are. It got really, really fun. It got really deep.
Sylvia Park. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to a sample from Luminous. Next week on Writer's Voice, we start Poetry Month, April, with a conversation with Forrest Gander about his novel and poetry, Mojave Ghosts. It takes us to his birthplace in the Mojave Desert and to his current Northern California home, where tumultuous memories coalesce with the present. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.